If you aren't on the list of people who have registered, it means that you signed up after 5:30 last evening. Print your name and then put 4:10. I'll reprint the list because I know that people sign up just before class. So you put your name down and put 4:10 on the list. Also, if anybody needs CEUs, need to do two things. You need to fill out an orange card and see me, and you need to also put your name and your license number and sign in for today on the CEU sign-in sheet. So, Derek, first thing, Chris.
Did the username and password change to get on the Wi-Fi system here? I tried logging on and it failed twice.
I have no idea. They couldn't get on. There was some problem with getting on, so it may have been a failure of the system. Because they just got me on. I don't know anything more. So try again. Maybe it's okay, but the system was not okay.
Does Carlos know? Is that what's up again?
Doug was. All three of them were.
Okay.
But try again, because they just got me on. So Chris was next.
Just are you still opening for the class?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So if you haven't signed up, you can go after class and sign up. But then also put your name on there so I know who's here. Let's see. Lennon and Derek.
Spence, I think your girlfriend's really cute.
Wait till we put the lights down, you can see. Okay,
thank you.
Derek.
I'm going to change the question. Is it still current in Campbell City?
Okay, is that the way you get on?
That's what for me.
Current, but not, no capital E.
Yeah, correct. Current capital C events.
And, but E events not good.
Yes.
All one word?
No. Username, current, password, events.
Okay, and current with a capital C and events not with a capital.
Yes. Did it change?
Well, you know what we'll do after class? We'll get off and we'll try to get back on, okay? We'll use this, okay? But I'm not going to get off now because I'm afraid I'll never get on again. Other questions? Okay, we're kind of getting settled and then we'll get going. Anything else? Crossing Project's latest offerings. Shared Crossing Project has to do with being close to death and to people who are dying and to help them with the dying process. It's William Peters and his associates, and he's come to class and talked three times, and many people from this class have been involved with that. Also, Judith, what do you want to say something?
Morgan Life is starting in May. There'll be four Thursdays in May. Instead of Tuesdays with Maury, it's fourth Thursday with Dave Rico. And it's Morgan Life. I have flyers, and I'll get them in the car. I'll put them over there.
Okay, good. So there will be flyers for Word and Life on the table. When, Judith?
It's fourth Thursday.
No, I meant when will the flyers be there?
At the break.
We don't have a break.
I'll get them now after we finish.
Okay. Okay, yeah, well, there's a video, so that would be a good time. What am I doing with this? I don't know. Okay. This term, what we're going to be doing is looking at the expansion of consciousness. And today, particularly, we're going to be looking at how consciousness can be expanded, consciousness of the physical world can be expanded, and then we're going to start looking at how consciousness of the inner world can be expanded. And we'll continue with that next week. Then in 3 weeks, Dave Humes comes and talks to us about death and the shaman's view of how consciousness opens at death. And then in 4 weeks, Dave Rico comes to this class, and he decided that he wanted to talk about mysticism in religion, because what we're talking about is mysticism. So that's at least what we're going to do for most of the first 4 classes, subject to change at a moment's notice. Let's see. Okay, so today what we're going to do is I will guide you through a mindfulness session, because it is the first class of the term. So I want to make sure, A, that everybody understands what we're doing when we meditate, and secondly, because it's always nice to get guidance. Then after we do that, I'll show you a video which has to do with the expansion of consciousness of the physical world in a rather remarkable high-tech way. And then we'll start our consideration of ontological, the nature of ontological, the basis of everything. Ontological whatever. ontology means the basic nature of things, so when you say ontological something, you're repeating yourself. All right, so Gary here? Gary Becker? Just for him, I came up with this. He's always asking, what is this witness thing? I mean, how do you get to the witness? And I keep trying to make it simpler and simpler. So I think I got it about as simple as you can get, which is, you're already witnessing. It's already a quality of your awareness. It's just not a quality of your awareness that is continuous and that is very salient to you. When you track where your attention goes, you're witnessing. So when you hear something and you realize you're hearing it, you're both hearing it and realizing you're hearing it. The realizing part is the witnessing part. If you're thinking and you're lost in thought, you don't realize where your attention is. But when you realize that there's something on your mind, you're witnessing your thoughts. So the witnessing perspective is just the continuous tracking of your attention as it moves. It's as though your attention is a searchlight, and it goes to thoughts, and then feelings, and sensations. It goes... You hear something, and then you think something, and then you feel something, and then you think something, and then you think something, and then you hear something, and then something itches, and then you feel something. So your attention is going like this, very rapidly, usual life. As we sit and meditate, it's a little slower. But it's going like this, and you're just, instead of looking at the things that are being illuminated by your attention, you're just taking one step back and sitting with the operator of the searchlight, watching the operator of the searchlight move attention around. So you're just looking at it. Oh, so you're going from here, this, to... Oh, there's a thought, there's a feeling, there's a thought. And that capacity is very trainable, and that's what we're learning to do. In open awareness meditation, in mindfulness, you just open the awareness to notice these things without trying to affect them at all. You don't try to change anything. Because you are noticing without being caught up, the changes happen by themselves. Typically better than would happen if you tried to make the changes. So it's not that this isn't therapeutic, it's just not therapeutic in the sense that you're actively struggling with these things. Most of the world's meditations are not open awareness meditations, they're concentration meditations. They say, forget about everything else except for one thing and focus exclusively on it. So they still involve manipulating attention, but now you're manipulating attention by putting it somewhere so that it becomes your focus. And we're going to look at what possibilities open up when you use that kind of meditation later in today's class. Okay, so that's a little preamble. Now we'll sit, yeah? All right, so okay. So the question is, what about mantra meditation? What kind is that? That's a concentration meditation, because when your mind goes anywhere else, you bring it back to the mantra. You keep bringing it back to the mantra. And then mantra meditation can be an open awareness meditation, because after a while, you can effortlessly say the mantra and notice other things without getting caught up in them. So these things aren't exclusive. They're just different routes to the same ultimate goal.
Let's see if this works. Is this a reasonable level of volume for you? Yeah, can everyone hear? You can't hear when you're in. Good, everyone can hear. Okay, I have to use this because I'm going to be, I can't be broadcasting while I'm meditating, okay? If anyone comes in, it's just something to pay attention to, okay? If anyone needs to leave, it's just something to pay attention to. In this kind of meditation, you're just opening your awareness around your breathing to notice whatever you notice. You're just tracking where your awareness goes. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to lead you through a little bit of progressive body relaxation, which is very helpful, and then suggest that you just notice for a few minutes whatever is happening. Now, I'll give you, at the very end of the meditation, I'll give you 2 minutes. And in those 2 minutes, I'll say there's 2 minutes left. If you want, if you know what metta is, that is putting people in your heart or flowing love out to people or praying for people, that's a good time to do that in the last 2 minutes. Also, if you know about labeling, that is saying silently to yourself what you're aware of as that awareness changes, as your attention moves, just calling out to yourself what's being illuminated by your attention. You can try that in the middle sometime. It really helps the focus. So I generally label for a minute or two after I've quieted myself down, and it gives me good focus for noticing what's happening. So, sit comfortably, but not rigidly. So you're comfortable but upright. Both feet on the floor. If your shoes are pinching your feet, you can take them off or loosen them. If you can't breathe, it might be, it might be a good idea to make sure you can breathe, since we're going to be focusing on breathing. And breathe with your whole body. That is, just let, as you have an in-breath, let your body open up a little bit. That is, your belly will come out, your chest will rise a little bit. If we could look, if we had a very acute measurement of your arms and hands, we would, and shoulders, you would see they would open a little, your legs would open a little on the in-breath. On the out-breath, everything would go the opposite way, kind of fold down a little bit. So you breathe with your whole body. Let's let Laura in. If somebody's close by there, let her in. Otherwise, she's going to pound the door down on me. So either look down with your eyes open or close your eyes. And just feel that you're breathing. Just let yourself breathe as you're breathing. Don't try to affect it at all. What will happen is you'll calm down. Your eyes are closed, or you're looking down with your eyes open. And so it's relaxing. And your whole system will come to a calmer way of functioning. And by paying attention to your breathing, you help calm yourself down, because it's soothing to be aware of your breathing. And you let your body make any slight postural adjustments it needs to make yourself more comfortable and to let go of tension. And that process can happen throughout the time when we're sitting. Whenever your body needs to adjust itself, let it do that. So you'll drop tension progressively. If you just being aware of your breathing, you're not trying to focus exclusively on your breathing, you're just noticing your breathing. You'll also notice other things. Thoughts, feelings, sensations. Whatever you notice, include it in the meditation. Don't try to get away from it. Don't block it out. Just include it. So you're feeling your breathing just happening gently. As though it's not as though your body opens up a little bit as the in breath comes in, as the out breath goes out, your body closes down a little bit. And you're just allowing your awareness to settle down onto your breathing, so that your awareness of your breathing becomes more continuous. Sometimes your awareness will go to something else, I'll direct it to something else, or it will just go by itself to something else. That's fine. When you realize you've lost awareness of your breathing, just gently bring your awareness back to your breathing. Just open your awareness around your breathing. So you feel your breathing, and you notice whatever else is happening. That's mindfulness, simple as that. But it's not a question of becoming less aware, it's a question of becoming more aware. Pay special attention now to your face. Let your face soften and open. So if there's any tension, typically we walk around with an expression on our face and it has a characteristic pattern of tension associated. Let that tension release itself. So your face softens. The lines in your face smooth out. Probably feel your face tingle as you soften it, or as it softens. Especially if you pay attention to your eyes, let your eyes be very soft. Softly closed or softly open, looking down. You'll notice a tingling in the muscles of your eyes. We overuse those muscles so much that when you soften them, when you let them relax, you can actually feel it. You're just letting your face soften. Your nose and your cheeks softening. And you're not making this happen, you're just letting it happen. Mouth and jaw. If you're holding any tension in your mouth and jaw area, see if you can just let it melt away, let it release itself. So your jaw is soft, and your mouth is either softly closed or may even come slightly open. So as your face softens, your body softens. And of course, you can feel your breathing. So you're softening and opening up. It's as though everything is releasing and opening. It's almost as though your face isn't even there anymore. It's as though it's disappeared, and there's just openness. There's just spaciousness where there used to be faciousness. Breeze could blow right through where your face used to be. And this softening and opening happens at the side of your head, back of your head, and top of your head, and even in your brain. So the back of your head and the sides of your head and the top of your head and your brain soften and open. Tension is released. Just blows away. And the solidity of your face and head give way to spaciousness, turn into just openness. A breeze could blow right through where your head used to be. And you can feel your breathing just happening naturally. Don't try to change your breathing. It will change itself. It will adjust itself to become more peaceful. If you're feeling any fatigue, let yourself feel that. Don't fight that. Just let it run through you. It will run through you and then fall away. So you can become very relaxed and still remain quite aware. It's very easy. So you're feeling yourself breathe. You're feeling yourself soften and open gradually. Pay special attention now to your neck and shoulders, arms and hands. Let your neck and shoulders, arms and hands soften and open. If there's any tension in the neck and shoulders, arms and hands, let it melt away. So it's almost as though your neck and shoulders, arms and hands are disappearing as they become relaxed, as they open, as they soften. It's almost as though they disappear. And there's just spaciousness, openness, where there used to be solidity. And whatever else you're aware of, you just include it. So everything is part of this spacious awareness. Or included in this spacious awareness. And you feel yourself breathe gently and easily. And your neck and shoulders, arms and hands continue to soften and open, almost disappear. Become aware of your torso now. Upper back, mid back, lower back. Sides of your body. Front of your body. Chest and abdomen. Feel your torso softening. Feel your torso opening. Include the internal organs. So that your internal organs soften and function smoothly, easily, harmoniously. It's almost as though your torso, your back, sides, and front of your torso, it's almost as though those areas are disappearing. They're becoming so soft and open. It's almost like they're turning into spaciousness rather than solid matter. It's as though a breeze could blow right through where your torso used to be. And you can feel your gentle breathing just happening naturally, easily. Anything else is happening, you just notice it. Don't try to do anything about it. It's just part of the meditation. Pay special attention now to your lower body, lower back, pelvis, legs and feet. Let your lower back and pelvis, legs and feet soften and open. If there's any tension in your lower back, pelvis, legs and feet, let it release itself. So your lower body is becoming so open, so relaxed, that it's almost as though it's disappearing. And the solidity of your lower body is turning into spaciousness. It's almost as though you're floating on a cloud or floating in the air. And your lower body is insubstantial and wide open. And you can feel your gentle breathing happening softly, easily. It's as though you've become an unbounded spaciousness, an unbounded field of awareness with no edges, just stretching to infinity in all directions. And this infinite spaciousness, in the middle of it is your breathing and your viewpoint. So you just notice your breathing and you open your awareness to notice whatever is happening on whatever level it happens. So if there are sounds, you hear the sounds. There are thoughts, you hear the thoughts or see the thoughts. There are feelings, you notice the feelings. And you keep noticing your breathing. Don't try to change anything you're noticing. Just notice it. If you like, you can label for a minute or two what you're noticing. You can call out to yourself silently what is the predominant thing you're noticing. Or, if you don't even want to make that effort, just notice. Just track what you're aware of. If you're making any effort, let go of the effort to notice. You don't have to make an effort to notice. It happens effortlessly. So you just continue to allow the softening and opening become ever more profound. You feel your breathing. You continue to open in every dimension. And just notice what occurs. If nothing occurs, Just notice the capacity to notice. Just notice the receptive awareness that is present. If you're caught up in thought, come back to your breathing, open your awareness. But you don't have to try to change the thought or stop the thought. Just notice the thinking. But at the same time, be aware of your breathing and open your awareness. If you get caught up in thought, notice how it takes your attention and absorbs it, and you forget about your breathing. And then, when you remember, you come back to your breathing, and you open your awareness. So notice the difference between being absorbed in thought and being present with whatever is happening, including thought. I'll ring the bell in about 2 minutes. So in these last 2 minutes, if you want to do metta or pray for people or send love to people, now would be a good time to do that in a very clear and focused way. If not, continue to breathe, soften and open, and be aware of whatever is happening. So I'll ring the bell in 2 minutes.
It's a skill, and it takes practice. So whatever you experience, congratulate yourself for having put in the effort, the non-effort that's an effort, to do what you just did. And if you feel like or have heard that there might be some benefit from this, then you might want to practice this on a regular basis. Not for as long as we did, but for when you're starting out for 5 minutes a day, something like that. So that it just becomes something that you get familiar with, and it starts to open up for you when you hear various things that you want to try. And so you eventually you tailor your practice to your personality. Carrie, loud.
You said to breathe with your whole body. For me, that takes effort. And then you say, I'm never going to just relax and breathe normally.
Oh, okay. So Carrie said, I said, breathe with the whole body, and it seems to take effort. And then I said, just relax. And they seem to be antithetical. Don't try to breathe with your whole body. Just breathe whatever way that you naturally breathe. And you will find that what happens is there's a subtle involvement of your whole body in the natural way that you breathe. But don't try to change the breathing. There are various meditation procedures that involve changing the breathing in various ways. That's not what mindfulness is. So sometimes you can use those pranayama techniques in league with mindfulness. But the point for your question is don't try to change to breathe in any particular way. Just notice how the natural breathing takes place. So maybe one more question or comment, and then we have to move from this. By the way, usually we sit for 10 minutes at the beginning without a lot of instruction. This was because it's the first session. So anybody else want to ask? Len.
Spencer, as you get into consciousness, would you give some consideration to talking about the importance of insight and how it plays into consciousness?
Okay, so the question is, what about insight? Actually, mindfulness meditation used to be called insight meditation after it was called Vipassana. I can talk about it extremely briefly because this says it. When you're here, you can't see the forest for the trees. That's called normal life. And one part of you fights against another part of you, and you kind of don't know what's going on, and you're kind of lost in this bubble around your head all the time. When you're mindful, you notice the me show, and you gain great insight. When I think that, I feel that way, and I have that sensation. When I think about my co-worker, I want to throw up. I have a tremendous welling of anger, and I want to throw up. And when I sit and meditate, a particular set of sensations and emotions springs forth, and I realize I've been carrying these through my whole life. This has been my level of tension and patterning my whole life, and I go, wow. That could create a lot of difficulty, that particular pattern of tension. What could I do about that? And then, with practice, you can make very precise changes in the functioning of thoughts, feelings, or sensations from the mindful perspective. But don't start that at the beginning. You're just here trying to, one part fixing another part. This is a question of being mindful, and when you see a very skillful means, they call it, a very deft tweaking to do, then you can do that and you can profoundly affect the functioning of the whole system. But insight is just being here, noticing how the me show, how me works. You gain insight into yourself, and you also gain insight into sight, into inner sight. That is, after a while, this is such a bore that more of your attention is recursive. It goes back on itself and it says, what is this attention that's the real me that is manifesting as all these symptoms, the outer me? So you begin to gain insight into the process of being conscious. And that's the door to spiritual realization. So there was a question. What's your first name? No, you.
Christina.
Christina.
I was taught in mindfulness that all of those things you wrote out, that you don't validate, that you're aware of them, but that you do not validate them.
There's a subtle, Christina says, she's taught that you don't validate these things. That's true, but you also don't discount them. That is, people in use mindfulness to get away, to dissociate.
No.
That stuff is going to come back and bite you in the rear. So you can't do that. What you do is you honor those things, but you don't invest more and more energy into them. You, in fact, consolidate the energy in that you bring the energy out of those patterns so that those patterns gradually transform because you're not reinforcing them. So, yeah, you don't make these stronger. You, in fact, gradually lessen the hold that these things have on who you are. Annie?
The insight, the thing about insight, when you're sufficiently quiet and open, answers or awarenesses crystallize and are liberating. That's the insight you probably asked about.
Okay, so what Annie is saying is when you're quiet and this isn't preoccupying you, there's an openness that can entertain answers that aren't the usual way of functioning. Whether they come from your unconscious or from superconscious or from spiritual, but they come. Creative and remarkable understandings come to you when you're not so preoccupied by the usual way of functioning that there's no room for them. It's why creativity happens when you're in the bath, when you're sleeping, when you're going for a walk in nature. That's when the mind is quiet enough so that more profound kinds of understandings can crystallize in your words. Okay. All right, enough of this. We got to. Okay, one more question. What's your first name?
Diane.
Diane, right?
Diana.
Diane, that's what I thought. It's a loud Diane.
Spencer, who is that sweet
redhead? Say it again?
Who is that sweet redhead?
Oh, we're going there right now. Okay. We're going there right now. Okay, so we're gonna move week after week. We'll explore mindfulness and its practice and utility. Now we have to move. Okay, so we're gonna watch a video, but this is the screensaver. Now, as it gets, I'll show you. Okay.
All right, so I gotta go like this.
Yes, thank you, Annie.
Okay. Let's see.
As much as you can. And that one too. Okay. And these things are okay. See, they're all down. The lights are still on. Oh, okay. I think it's okay. All right. So this is Sophie, 5-year-old golden retriever that bothers me a lot. This is a dog that I love more than all the dogs that I love. But this is, I just took this picture a couple of months ago. And I just thought I'd put it up because I really love to look at it. That's her usual. She's delighted by life. A teacher. Okay, so enough of that.
What's her name?
Her name is Sophia. Sophie, S-O-F-I. As in the Greek goddess of wisdom, I guess. And what I've heard is in Michelangelo's picture of the god touching Adam, I think next to God is Sophia. That's what somebody called me. What are we getting out of here? What do we do? We have to push this kid. Oh, you want to go next? Okay.
Now we're going to hear.
Okay, so this is, some of you have probably seen this. It's certainly worth seeing more than once. This is William Eagleman, David Eagleman, who actually came 2 years ago, I think, to Campbell Hall, talk about synesthesia. Really a good talk. Anyway, this is a new TED Talk. The question is, when you were little, did you ever wish either that your senses worked better, so you could hear things that other people couldn't hear or see things other people couldn't see? Or I used to wish that that there were colors that nobody had ever seen that I could see, you know? Or did you wish that you had different other senses so you could see other aspects of reality that you couldn't see right now? Well, it turns out that through technology, you actually can perceive the world in an enhanced way versus the way that we normally perceive the world. And so this is a kind of startling talk about enlarging consciousness of the physical world in ways which are now realizable. So you'll see.
Remember to tell me to tell people.
Small stuff, and we are embedded in a very large cosmos, and the fact is that we are not very good at understanding reality at either of those scales, and that's because our brains haven't evolved to understand the world at that scale. Instead, we're trapped on this very thin slice of perception right in the middle. But it gets strange because even at that slice of reality that we call home, we're not seeing most of the action that's going on. So take the colors of our world. This is light waves, electromagnetic radiation, that bounces off objects, and it hits specialized receptors in the back of our eyes. But we're not seeing all the waves out there. In fact, what we see is less than a 10 trillionth of what's out there. So you have radio waves and microwaves and x-rays and gamma rays passing through your body right now, and you're completely unaware of it because you don't come with the proper biological receptors for picking it up. There are thousands of cell phone conversations passing through you right now, and you're utterly blind to it. Now, it's not that these things are inherently unseeable. Snakes include some infrared in their reality. And honeybees include ultraviolet in their view of the world. And of course, we build machines in the dashboards of our cars to pick up on signals in the radio frequency range. And we build machines in hospitals to pick up on the x-ray range. But you can't sense any of those by yourself, at least not yet, because you don't come equipped with the proper sensors. Now, what this means is that our experience of reality is constrained by our biology. And that goes against the common sense notion that our eyes and our ears and our fingertips are just picking up the objective reality that's out there. Instead, our brains are sampling just a little bit of the world. Now, across the animal kingdom, different animals pick up on different parts of reality. So in the blind and deaf world of the tick, the important signals are temperature and butyric acid. In the world of the black ghost nightfish, its sensory world is lavishly colored by electrical fields. And for the echolocating bats, its reality is constructed out of air compression waves. That's the slice of their ecosystem that they can pick up on. And we have a word for this in science. It's called the Umwelt, which is the German word for the surrounding world. Now, presumably, every animal assumes that its Umwelt is the entire objective reality out there. Because why would you ever stop to imagine that there's something beyond what we can sense? Instead, what we all do is we accept reality as it's presented to us. So let's do a consciousness raiser on this. Imagine that you were a bloodhound dog. Your whole world is about smelling. You've got a long snout that has 200 million scent receptors in it, and you have wet nostrils that attract and trap scent molecules, and your nostrils even have slits so you can take big nosefuls of air. Everything is about smell for you. So one day, you stop in your tracks with a revelation. You look at your human owner and you think, what is it like to have the pitiful, impoverished nose of a human? What is it like when you take a feeble little nose full of air? How can you not know that there's a cat 100 yards away? Or that your neighbor was on this very spot 6 hours ago? So because we're humans, we've never experienced that world of smell, so we don't miss it. Because we are firmly settled into our Umwelt. But the question is, do we have to be stuck there? So as a neuroscientist, I'm interested in the way that technology might expand our Umwelt and how that's going to change the experience of being human. So we already know that we can marry our technology to our biology, because there are hundreds of thousands of people walking around with artificial hearing and artificial vision. So the way this works is you take a microphone and you digitize the signal and you put an electrode strip directly into the inner ear. Or with a retinal implant, you take a camera and you digitize the signal and then you plug an electrode grid directly into the optic nerve. And as recently as 15 years ago, there were a lot of scientists who thought these technologies wouldn't work. Why? It's because these technologies speak the language of Silicon Valley, and it's not exactly the same dialect as our natural biological sense organs. But the fact is that it works. The brain figures out how to use the signals just fine. Now, how do we understand that? Well, here's the big secret. Your brain is not hearing or seeing any of this. Your brain is locked in a vault of silence and darkness inside your skull. All it ever sees are electrochemical signals that come in along different data cables, and this is all it has to work with, and nothing more. Now, amazingly, the brain is really good at taking in these signals and extracting patterns and assigning meaning, so that it takes this inner cosmos and puts together a story of this, your subjective world. But here's the key point. Your brain doesn't know, and it doesn't care, where it gets the data from. Whatever information comes in, it just figures out what to do with it. And this is a very efficient kind of machine. It's essentially a general purpose computing device, and it just takes in everything and figures out what it's going to do with it, and that, I think, frees up Mother Nature to tinker around with different sorts of input channels. So I call this the pH model of evolution, and I don't want to get too technical here, but pH stands for potato head, and I use this name to emphasize that all these sensors that we know and love, like our eyes and our ears and our fingertips, these are merely peripheral plug-and-play devices. You stick them in and you're good to go. The brain figures out what to do with the data that comes in. And when you look across the animal kingdom, you find lots of peripheral devices. So snakes have heat pits with which to detect infrared. And the ghost nightfish has electroreceptors. And the star-nosed mole has this appendage with 22 fingers on it with which it feels around and constructs a 3D model of the world. And many birds have magnetite so that they can orient to the magnetic field of the planet. So what this means is that nature doesn't have to continually redesign the brain. Instead, with the principles of brain operation established, all nature has to worry about is designing new peripherals. Okay, so what this means is this. The lesson that surfaces is that there's nothing really special or fundamental about the biology that we come to the table with. It's just what we have inherited from a complex road of evolution. But it's not what we have to stick with. And our best proof of principle of this comes from what's called sensory substitution. And that refers to feeding information into the brain via unusual sensory channels. And the brain just figures out what to do with it. Now, that might sound speculative, but the first paper demonstrating this was published in the journal Nature in 1969. So scientists named Paul Bakke-Rita put blind people in a modified dental chair, and he set up a video feed, and he put something in front of the camera, and then you would feel that poked into your back with a grid of solenoids. So if you wiggle a coffee cup in front of the camera, you're feeling that in your back. And amazingly, blind people got pretty good at being able to determine what was in front of the camera just by feeling it in the small of their back. Now, there have been many...
I just hope it kicks back on. I'd be interested to know if it was blind from birth or not, because how would you be able to relate to that image?
Yeah,
if you were actually
blind from birth, people couldn't do that.
Okay, so maybe what I
mean. Modern incarnations of this. The sonic glasses take a video feed right in front of you and turn that into a sonic landscape. So as things move around, you get closer and farther, it sounds like sounds like a cacophony. But after several weeks, blind people start getting pretty good at understanding what's in front of them just based on what they're hearing. And it doesn't have to be through the ears. This system uses an electro-tactile grid on the forehead. So whatever in front of the video feed, you're feeling it on your forehead. Why the forehead? Because you're not using it for much else. The most modern incarnation is called the brain port. And this is a little electro grid that sits on your tongue. And the video feed gets turned into these little electro-tactile signals. And blind people get so good at using this that they can throw a ball into a basket, or they can navigate complex obstacle courses. They can come to see through their tongue. Now that sounds completely insane, right? But remember, all vision ever is electrochemical signals coursing around in your brain. Your brain doesn't know where the signals come from, it just figures out what to do with them. So my interest in my lab is sensory substitution for the deaf. And this is a project I've undertaken with a graduate student in my lab, Scott Novick, who's spearheading this for his thesis. And here's what we wanted to do. We wanted to make it so that sound from the world gets converted in some way so that a deaf person can understand what is being said. And we wanted to do this given the power and ubiquity of portable computing. We wanted to make sure that this would run on cell phones and tablets. And also, we wanted to make this a wearable, something that you could wear under your clothing. So here's the concept. So as I'm speaking, my sound is getting captured by the tablet, and then it's getting mapped onto a vest that's covered in vibratory motors, just like the motors in your cell phone. So as I'm speaking, the sound is getting translated to a pattern of vibration on the vest. Now, this is not just conceptual. This tablet is transmitting Bluetooth, and I'm wearing the vest right now. So as I'm speaking, the sound is getting translated into dynamic patterns of vibration. I'm feeling the sonic world around me. So we've been testing this with deaf people now, and it turns out that after just a little bit of time, people can start feeling, they can start understanding the language of the vest. So this is Jonathan. He's 37 years old. He has a master's degree. He was born profoundly deaf, which means that there's a part of his umwelt that's unavailable to him. So we had Jonathan train with the vest for 4 days, 2 hours a day, and here he is on the fifth day.
You.
So Scott says a word, Jonathan feels it on the vest, and he writes it on the board.
Where? Where?
Jonathan's able to translate this complicated pattern of vibrations into an understanding of what's being said.
Touch. Touch.
Now, he's not doing this... Jonathan's not doing this consciously because the patterns are too complicated, but his brain is starting to unlock the pattern that allows it to figure out what the data mean. And our expectation is that after wearing this for about 3 months, he will have a direct perceptual experience of hearing. In the same way that when a blind person passes a finger over Braille, the meaning comes directly off the page without any conscious intervention at all. Now, this technology has the potential to be a game changer because the only other solution for deafness is a cochlear implant, and that requires an invasive surgery. And this can be built for 40 times cheaper than a cochlear implant, which opens up this technology globally, even for the poorest countries. Now, we've been very encouraged by our results with sensory substitution, but what we've been thinking a lot about is sensory addition. How can we use a technology like this to add a completely new kind of sense, to expand the human umwelt? For example, could we feed real-time data from the internet directly into somebody's brain, and can they develop a direct perceptual experience? So here's an experiment we're doing in the lab. A subject is feeling a real-time streaming feed from the net of data for 5 seconds. Then, two buttons appear, and he has to make a choice. He doesn't know what's going on. He makes a choice, and he gets feedback after 1 second. Now here's the thing. The subject has no idea what all the patterns mean, but we're seeing if he gets better at figuring out which button to press. He doesn't know that what we're feeding is real-time data from the stock market. And he's making buy and sell decisions. And the feedback is telling him whether he did the right thing or not. And what we're seeing is, can we expand the human umwelt so that he comes to have, after several weeks, a direct perceptual experience of the economic movements of the planet. So we'll report on that later to see how well this goes. Here's another thing we're doing. During the talks this morning, we've been automatically scraping Twitter for the 102015 hashtag, and we've been doing an automated sentiments analysis, which means are people using positive words or negative words or neutral? And while this has been going on, I have been feeling this. And so I plugged in to the aggregate emotion of thousands of people in real time. And that's a new kind of human experience, because now I can know how everyone's doing and how much you're loving this. It's a bigger experience than a human can normally have. We're also expanding the umwelt of pilots. So in this case, the vest is streaming 9 different measures from this quadcopter. So pitch and yaw and roll and orientation and heading, and that improves this pilot's ability to fly it. It's essentially like he's extending his skin up there, far away. And that's just the beginning. What we're envisioning is taking a modern cockpit full of gauges, and instead of trying to read the whole thing, you feel it. We live in a world of information now, and there's a difference between accessing big data and experiencing it. So I think there's really no end to the possibilities on the horizon for human expansion. Just imagine an astronaut being able to feel the overall health of the International Space Station. Or for that matter, having you feel the invisible states of your own health, like your blood sugar and the state of your microbiome, or having 360-degree vision, or seeing in infrared or ultraviolet. So the key is this. As we move into the future, we're going to increasingly be able to choose our own peripheral devices. We no longer have to wait for Mother Nature's sensory gifts on her timescales. But instead, like any good parent, she's given us the tools that we need to go out and define our own trajectory. So the question now is, how do you want to go out and experience your universe? Thank you.
This would be the first experiment that kind of secures its funding forevermore, right? If successful.
Well, that's right. I wouldn't have to write the NIH anymore.
But look, just to be skeptical for a minute, I mean, this is amazing, but isn't most of the evidence so far that sensory substitution works, not necessarily that sensory addition works? I mean, isn't it possible that the blind person can see through their tongue because they already have the neural set, the visual cortex is still there, ready to process, and that is needed as part of it?
This is a great question. We actually have no idea what the theoretical limits are, what kind of data the brain can take in. The general story, though, is that it's extraordinarily flexible. So when a person goes blind, what we used to call their visual cortex gets taken over by other things, by touch, by hearing, by vocabulary. So what that tells us is that the cortex is kind of a one-trick pony. It just runs certain kind of computations on things. And, you know, when we look around things like Braille, for example, people are getting information through bumps on their fingers. So I don't think we have any reason to think that there's a theoretical limit that we know the edge of.
If this checks out, you're all going to be deluged by, I mean, there are so many possible applications for this. Are you ready for this? What are you most excited about?
Yeah. I think there's a lot of applications here in terms of beyond sensory substitution. The things I started mentioning about astronauts on the space station, they spend a lot of their time monitoring things, and they could instead just get what's going on, because what this is really good for is multidimensional data. The key is this. Our visual systems are good at detecting blobs and edges, but they're really bad at what our world has become, which is screens with lots and lots of data. We have to crawl that with our attentional systems. So this is a way of just feeling the state of something, just like the way you know the state of your body as you're standing around. So I think having machinery, safety, feeling the state of a factory, of your equipment, that's one place we'll go right away.
David Eagleman, that was one mind-blowing talk. Thank you very much.
Instead of the lights on, let's have this up, and we'll talk a tiny bit about this. Okay, so you might want to see that more than once. That the profundity of what's possible is really something. I wish I could take off my jacket and have the vest and know how you're feeling about what you just saw and what you know. Do you understand what he's doing with the Twitter thing? People are constantly saying stuff on Twitter, and you can do content analysis in real time of the positive and negative words that they use. And so you can find it at any given moment. If we could access Twitter now, and we could access all the information from Twitter, we would know the mood of the world at this moment. Or if we're just accessing your Twitter feeds, we would access your mood at this moment. So we could tell moment by moment how people were feeling. And you could actually feel that. So if you're talking about something and everybody's feeling bad about it, you shift your topic. So I'm sure some presidential candidate is going to be wearing this at the next debate. All right, so let me see. Fred first, and we'll go this way. Then Mary Beth, and then Michael. Okay, Fred. Loud.
Yeah, I'm concerned about overloading the brain with data. What kind of effects it might have on it?
I think two things. I think first,
You would know if you start, you know, when you start to get overwhelmed, then the brain shuts down automatically. It's not, it would tell you, it would become uncomfortable, it would let you know that it was exceeding its capacity. But I think probably that we have much more capacity than we generally use consciously. You know, much, the huge proportion of what the brain is doing is not, we're not aware of. So we're doing an enormous amount. This would just be one more feed and on a conscious level. That is, you know, if we have six, if we have five senses, it'd be another sense. And it would be a sense that would be available to consciousness. So I don't know the answer to that, but I'm not terribly worried about that. Who is next? Let's see, Marybeth.
The other concern is how would this interact with one's natural sense of intuition? Because there seems as if, you know, we all have a natural intuitive side and we respond according, you know, one way, like we may go out that door instead of that door, just because we intuit that that's correct. How could this potentially interfere and or enhance that?
I think it could either potentially interfere or enhance. To me, intuition is unconscious pattern recognition. That is, your brain is constantly processing an enormous amount of information. Richard told me, I'm going to bother you, Richard told me that the current estimate of how much information we're processing at any given time is we process about 100,000 times as much information without awareness as we do with awareness. So there's a lot of stuff coming in. And when some pattern is recognized that's important, it makes its way to the consciousness. So when you're talking to somebody, you say, I don't get a good feeling, you know, get a weird feeling about them. It's because you're looking at their body language and the sound of their voice and maybe the smell coming off them and you know, all kinds of other things. You're putting it all together and you're pairing it with what you know about that pattern from the past. And that was a creepy people were like that from the past. And so it comes into your mind, I don't know that I trust this guy. This might, if you have a lot of this stuff, it might prevent you from hearing your own voices, but it also might help you be better at paying attention to patterns that you are perceiving. So I don't know. I don't know. Richard, did you want to say something? Did your hand go up?
I was just going to mention that we actually did the funding for this on Kickstarter.
Really? He got the funding for this on Kickstarter. He didn't ask NIMH or NIH. He actually asked other people, will you kick in for this? That's interesting. Okay, so Michael.
As far as sensory substitution and enhancement, wouldn't it be one of the best examples, the brain mechanism of schizophrenia, how it's able to simulate sounds and vision and touch, but sort of through an intermediate way without even going through the eyes, the ears, the normal senses?
Yeah, what Michael's saying is people who are have so-called positive symptoms of schizophrenia, they hear stuff that isn't there. They see stuff that isn't there. The brain puts together a percept that didn't come through the sense organs. And I guess great artists, they kind of, their brain assembles sound or vision that or shape that never existed before. It makes a reality that didn't come in. Okay. Alice.
Mystics seem to be able to feel what's happening in the world in that sort of that same way.
So what Alice says is mystics seem to be able to feel things in a more profound way.
It could end war if we could all feel just what somebody else is.
If we could feel what the people that were bombing are feeling, it would make us less likely to bomb. In fact, that's the way that you get people to fight other people, is you dehumanize them. If you humanize them, people wouldn't hurt them. You know, so that's what propaganda is all about, is calling them subhuman names.
That kind of, what your comment kind of leads to the next thing we're going to do, which is what mystics actually perceive. We're going to go on a mystical journey. But anything else before we go on our mystical journey?
Okay. I
want
to, the name of the film once again.
Okay, so this is, first of all, what's your first name?
I'm Susan.
Susan, hi. So this is TED.com, TED.com, and this is David Eagleman. So you put in the search bar, Eagleman, and out it will come. It's TED.com, TED.com, and it says search, Eagleman. Click that, and you'll be able to find his talk. Okay, let's start this. Okay, so obviously this is going to be mostly what we're going to do next week. And probably it will persist for after we have our two guests, we'll come back to this. But this is audacious. What I'm about to do is audacious. And I put it off for a long time, both because it's so far beyond me, and also because it's kind of complicated and I have to read it to you. Because there's no way that I can teach this because I don't know it. So what I'm going to be doing is, and I'll do this next week, I'll read some of this. We will do this in bite-sized chunks because there's other things I want to do next week also. But what the question came up, Robert, who's not here, asked the question, what about enlightenment? Remember, I've been sidestepping that as best I can, ducking actually. All right, so I thought, all right, if you want to do the enlightenment thing, you want to know what enlightenment is in a profound way, this is the book. This book is called Coming Home by Lex Hickson, and it's, according to Ken Wilber, who wrote the foreword for it, the single best introductory book ever written on the world's great mystical traditions. This is an amazing book. And I'm going to skip all nine introductory chapters, which takes you into nine mystical systems from around the world. It takes you into Sufi mysticism, it takes you into Hasidic mysticism, it takes you into Christian mysticism, it takes you into mysticism from all these different points of view, and brings you intimately into these different mystical awarenesses. And then in the last chapter, he kind of wraps them all together. And says about, he talks about a point of view that incorporates all these different particular points of view. So this is kind of the overview of mysticism, or the template of, or the grand design of any mystical experience, which each of which has its own flavor depending on the culture from which it comes.
It's basically a ribbon of commonality lacing all of them together.
Yeah, that's a way to put it. They're all linked together in the way that he's going to talk about here. So Raven. Lex Hickson, Hixon. And this book, actually, I have an original copy of it. It was published, I think, first in 1979, and it went out of print. And people were so upset that it's now reprinted. And so this is the new printing of it. This is a book that was revived because people couldn't put it, ignore it. Len.
The title again, please.
Coming Home: The Experience of Enlightenment in Sacred Traditions. And Lex Hickson is very quickly. He's got a PhD in world religions from Columbia in 1976. First book was published in 1978 by Doubleday. I'll read his whole biography after we go through this. But he is initiated in numerous spiritual systems and actually leads groups in various spiritual systems. He's a master of many of the things that he talks about. He's not just a scholar; he's a practitioner and a master. Let's start, okay? Just to kind of set things up.
All right, how's that? Good?
Okay.
This 10th chapter, the last chapter of the book, is called Designing an Experiment in Contemplation. So he's going to tell you, if you really want to know this stuff firsthand, here's a way that you can go about it. It's kind of a remarkable and involved way. I don't think many of us are going to run it out and do this. But he also talks about... It's too loud, okay.
Let's see. Yeah, it sounds like it. So let's see if I can...
No, no, that's good. How's... That's not good. How's that?
Great.
Yeah. Is that good?
Yeah.
Everybody, yeah?
Yeah.
Perfect. Okay.
He not only talks about how to do this, he also talks about what you discover as you proceed. And that's what we're primarily interested in, is what realizations about reality happen as you deepen your contemplation. And so the subtitle of the chapter is Toward the Turiya of Advaita Vedanta. Turiya, T-U-R-I-Y-A. T-U-R-I-Y-A. It's a profound realization from Vedanta. Advaita Vedanta arose about 1,500 years ago in India. And it's a kind of Hinduism. But we're not going to get to the Advaita part until later in the chapter. So, as we explore various methods for controlling, heightening, or clarifying awareness, we should remember the profound teaching of enlightened persons from various cultures. Harmonious and balanced living, is not only the preparation for contemplation, but also the practice of contemplation and its ultimate goal. Harmonious and balanced living. The contemplative mood is the essence of our consciousness, not a condition to be imposed on it. Understanding that contemplation is primarily to live consciously and only secondarily involves formal practice. So, primarily to live consciously and only secondarily involving formal practice. We can then choose maturely a mode of contemplative life, a particular discipline of prayer or meditation. This is comparable to dance. If we can regard bodily movement as already dance, then when we enter some particular form of dance training, our appreciation of natural grace and spontaneity is deepened, not lost in the rigor or theory of the training. So the training doesn't override the natural presence of the grace. It just deepens it. Similarly, as we transform our lives into formal, liturgical, contemplative dance, we should retain complete freedom of movement. This freedom is the mystical sense that understands perfect prayer or meditation as the core of our being, spontaneously springing from the core of being itself, being with a capital B. I'll repeat it. Similarly, as we transform our lives into formal liturgical contemplative dance, we should retain complete freedom of movement. This freedom is the mystical sense that understands perfect prayer or meditation as the core of our being, spontaneously springing from the core of being itself. The beautiful structure of our spiritual practice should grow directly from the structureless ground of primal awareness. We should enjoy simultaneously the vision of the formal structure and its formless source. So we're doing whatever spiritual practice we do
built on the essential nature of reality as spiritual. Many seekers who undertake spiritual life through religion, many seekers who undertake spiritual life through religious commitment or esoteric study become too concerned with the aspect of structure. That is, they focus too much on the practice and not on the spirit of the practice. The opposite distortion is the refusal to recognize the value of structured practice. The person who has a narrowly structured or exclusive sense of spiritual practice can at least begin to develop like a seed planted in a small pot, which can later be transplanted into an open field. The person without a spiritual practice, however, is like a seed without soil. It can germinate, but it can't send down roots. So he's saying that if you want to develop a profound mystical sense of the world, you have to have a practice. As we explore various forms of contemplation, we should also remember that personal moral development provides the only reliable foundation for such experiments. That is, you have to be personally morally responsible to do these experiments. Compassion and clarity are the fruits of moral discipline, which is not a mechanical application of a system that defines... Okay. Compassion and clarity are the fruits of moral discipline, which is not mechanical application of the system that defines certain acts and impulses as good or evil, but is rather the continuous effort to express truthfulness and loving concern through all behavior and thinking. The continuing effort to express truthfulness and loving concern through all behavior and thinking. Without the balance created by this moral discipline, we could distort contemplative practice and the intoxicating experiences it can produce. Honesty with ourselves and responsiveness to others provide the ground for a potentially dangerous electricity of spiritual life. So, honesty with ourselves and responsiveness to others is necessary as we proceed in these higher realms of consciousness. That's the preamble, and that's where we stop for today. Next week, my current plan is to show you two really cool little videos at the beginning, and then we'll spend most of the class looking at what the practice is and what you discover at each point as the practice deepens. And what is this practice? It's the practice of what we call contemplation, which is awareness of the deeper nature of reality. Mysticism. That's where we're going.